Inflation, say the good people at Merriam-Webster, is a continuing rise in the general price level, usually attributed to an increase in the volume of money and credit relative to available goods and services. Yes, long, but that's the dictionary. Us, we'll tell you what it really means. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday today, the 30th day of March. Good, as always, to have you along, everybody. If you pay attention to business and economic news, and I'm going to guess by your presence here today that you do, and thank you. But if you pay attention to that stuff, you have likely heard of late a bunch of more than passing references to inflation. There are some people who are worried that with things opening up and boatloads of pent-up demand and all the stimulus that is in this economy, inflation is all but inevitable. Fed Chair Jay Powell, it has to be said, is not one of those people. But there is how the government looks at inflation, and then there's what inflation feels like to you and me. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams starts us off.
Inflation isn't inherently bad. It can signal a growing economy. To keep it simple, it's a way to look at what it costs to get by. Economist Carola Binder teaches at Haverford College in Pennsylvania. She says inflation can be a major focus for policymakers, but
most consumers don't think about it much at all. Or if they do, they might notice that prices of things that they buy frequently are going up.
If you drive a lot, maybe you notice gas prices. If you have a chronic condition, healthcare prices. Stephen Cacchetti is a professor at the Brandeis International Business School.
So remember, you only see on a daily or weekly basis a small part of what you spend.
But government economists,
they look at everything and they look at what everybody's doing on average.
To deal with this disconnect, says Tony Rodriguez, who heads fixed income strategy at Nuveen, economists strip out volatile data like gas prices, which can spike, say, when a big ship gets stuck in the Suez Canal. But policymakers also try to educate consumers because
as a broader segment of the population begins to expect higher inflation, their behavior changes like a self-fulfilling prophecy, you know,
Maybe workers ask for higher wages, or businesses start to stockpile goods and raise prices. And then those inflation expectations become just inflation. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
One of the reasons the Fed's not overly worried about inflation and is trying to manage those expectations that Kimberly was talking about right at the end there was something that Fed Vice Chair Richard Clarida said last week, that in addition to all the pent-up consumer demand after this past pandemic year, there's also the idea of pent-up supply.
The idea here is that there are many businesses that would really like to be producing a lot more than they are right now.
That's Tara Sinclair. She's at George Washington University. And those companies, they're either short-staffed or they've been temporarily closed.
One of the big images for me is just walking around the city and looking at storefronts that say, reopening soon or come back and visit us soon.
Which means in the near term,
it may be that we see some more demand for businesses because we haven't gotten everybody open yet.
But then
other businesses slowly open after that, and then that can readjust the economy again.
Which is what Powell and Clarida et al. Have been saying, that there's probably going to be some kind of spike in inflation. But then the pent-up supply meets all that pent-up demand, and things stabilize. They think. One more quick thing about rising prices here before we go on. Housing. Home prices were up at the fastest clip in a decade and a half in the 12 months ended in January. 11% in the big metro areas. That is the latest from the S&P CoreLogic Case-Shiller National Home Price Index, which came out today and is also the longest indicator name I think I say regularly on this radio program. The biggest increases in that index were all out west, Phoenix, Seattle, and San Diego. Marketplace's Samantha Fields has that one.
Almost every house that goes on the market in and around Seattle these days is selling for more than the asking price, and not just by a little.
Maybe $100,000 over to sometimes as much as $200,000 over asking.
Moira Hawley is a broker in Seattle. She's talking about single-family homes in the million-dollar range. She says a lot of buyers are waiving inspections and paying cash. That is true in San Diego, too.
There is so much cash.
Realtor Amy Bramey says she's never seen anything like it.
Cash is winning out. If there's a cash offer, typically the sellers will go for the cash offer.
And there often is at least one cash offer, Bramey says. She's working with one couple now that just put an offer in on a house that they've only seen on FaceTime.
When I called the agent to tell her I was putting the offer in, she said, okay, I have 23 offers right now.
It's a similar story in most metro areas around the country, partly because there are so few homes for sale and partly because mortgage rates have been so low. But Selma Hepp, an economist at CoreLogic, says the fact that home prices have risen so much in the last year,
it's not something that's scary.
Mostly because people are putting so much cash down when they're buying.
And so they have already equity built into their home coming in.
Which is a good thing for the economy, if not for people out there hoping to buy. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
Buying a house over FaceTime. Think about that. Wall Street today, it was a little soft. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Not only is the federal individual tax filing deadline pushed back this year, May 17th, as you might have heard, is the new deadline. Just yesterday, the IRS gave people more time to contribute to their health and retirement accounts as well. But there is one tax deadline that is staying put. April 15th is the due date for a lot of businesses to pay their estimated taxes for the first quarter of this year. And as Marketplace's Justin Ho reports, it has not been oh so easy for businesses to figure out how much they owe.
Estimated taxes are paid quarterly on income that isn't subject to withholding. They're paid by a lot of smaller businesses and self-employed people like Jackie London, who runs a public health consultancy in Denver, Colorado. This quarter, she says,
I'm putting that off as long as possible just to be able to save up what I'm estimating I will need.
Last year, London says she had a surprisingly good fourth quarter, but that meant she owed more in taxes than she expected. So now she's setting aside cash that she would have otherwise spent on a website or marketing.
It does get harder to really kind of justify that rather than just saving it and using it to pay for taxes or to make sure that I have a good buffer.
Estimated taxes are usually predictable, says Nicole Davis, owner of Butler Davis Tax and Accounting in Atlanta. But this year, she says many businesses aren't sure what to expect. And some, like her hospitality clients, are still struggling.
They just don't have the cash to make the payments because they're using all their money to support the business.
But some businesses that have managed to hang on through the pandemic are finally at a point where they can afford to set aside money for taxes. Randy George is co-owner of Red Hen Baking Company in Vermont.
Most of us, if we're not shuttered completely, are okay from a cash flow perspective because we got the second round of the PPP.
George says he's using his 2019 budget to figure out how much he'll owe in estimated taxes this year. 2020, he says, just isn't a helpful guide. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
If you don't need them now, or maybe haven't ever needed them since they were on you, you may not realize this, but even before the pandemic, one in three families in this economy that needed diapers couldn't afford them. You had a year's worth of pandemic, millions of jobs losses, and a recovering but still not back to normal economy, and you got a problem. A problem that is showing up, among other places, at diaper banks. There are more than 200 of them in this country, and like food banks, they're all different, and for a lot of families, crucial, as Marketplace's Erica Barris reports.
In the early days of the pandemic, when people were scouring store shelves for toilet paper, they were also making a run on diapers and wipes. That was a problem for Charlene Hughes in Missouri, who works at the St. Louis area diaper bank.
We couldn't get a shipment. The supply line was shut down. So I spent probably 3 or 4 weekends just driving around the Walmarts.
Hughes circled the suburbs looking for diapers. Her bank now gives out 250,000 diapers a month. nearly double what they used to before the pandemic. Back then, they typically had 60 to 100 volunteers a week, but not this past year.
We were bringing our family members in on the weekend, our quarantine circles, staggering them throughout the week. Some of us were working 12, 14 hours just to make sure we could get the product in, get it bundled, and get it out.
Kids use anywhere from 5 to 12 diapers a day, or more, for the first 3 years of their lives. That's an expense of at least $80 a month, and that doesn't include wipes. And without diapers, Hughes says parents can get desperate.
They may take multiple T-shirts and tie them around babies. They may take the last soiled diaper and call themselves cleaning it out, or line it with newspaper or line it with pads, anything absorbent, or line it with a towel until they can get what they need.
Across the country, demand at diaper banks has increased, says Joanne Samuel Goldblum, CEO and founder of the National Diaper Bank Network. She calls diapers a sort of window into poverty.
And the reason for that is because it lets you know that your neighbor is potentially so poor that their child is sitting in their own mess all day.
Depending on the baby, even one dirty diaper can lead to a rash, which can easily get infected. And the effects aren't only physical. Megan Smith at Yale University studies the mental health of low-income mothers. She's found that diaper need is a predictor of postpartum depression in mothers and can make it difficult for mothers and babies to form an attachment.
If that's the way you know how to soothe your baby and you can't do it because you don't have a sufficient supply of diapers, it does become this issue around, you know, child development, child well-being.
It's one of those scary things.
Ashley Bass in Jerseyville, Illinois, has gotten diapers from banks for her five-month-old daughter.
If you can't afford something for your kid, you kind of feel like you kind of feel hopeless, like, can you really take care of a child?
Bass says she gets government help with her housing, her food, her health care. But diapers and wipes aren't covered by any federal government program. Jennifer Randall's a sociology professor, studies the intersection of race, class, and gender at California State University, Fresno. She says parents' need for diapers, as well as for work, can be a double bind.
If they are struggling with diaper need and can't get diapers because they can't afford it or because of what's happened with the pandemic, they can't leave their children with a childcare provider. They can't go to work. And then it just exacerbates that cycle of, you know, lost hours at the job and possibly risking losing their job entirely.
But over the past year, we've already seen parents, including a disproportionate number of women, leaving the workforce, which may mean diaper banks will continue to be busier than ever. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I think that there's an interesting analogy to be made here.
All right, I'm all ears. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's down 104 today, 0.3%, 33,066. The NASDAQ shed 14 points, about 0.1%, 13,045. S&P 500 down 12, 0.3%, 39,058. BioNTech shot up 8.8% today after the biotech firm raised its goal for the number of vaccines it will produce. The company's aiming for 2.5 billion doses manufactured by the end of this year, compared to its earlier prediction of 2.3 to 2.4 billion. BioNTech's vaccine partner Pfizer off 1.3% today. Johnson & Johnson down 0.6%. Bonds basically steady. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note 1.72%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. One of the biggest human migration stories of the past 20 years or so has been people from the Chinese countryside moving to the cities looking for economic opportunity. Hundreds of millions of people have done that. A year of this pandemic, though, has pushed some of those people back out of the cities, as Marketplace's Jennifer Pack reports now from Shanghai.
Real estate agent Eric He wears his hair short and slightly tousled, paired with a fitted black jacket. He blends in easily in Shanghai, but he's a second-class citizen here when it really counts, like finding a spouse. We went to the marriage market at People's Park on a weekend, just before the COVID-19 lockdown. Parents advertise their unmarried children's qualities on handwritten notes and tack them on umbrellas. Eric He read one of the ads.
Born in 1991, single, female, height 5'3", pale skin beauty, has a master's degree from Newcastle University in the UK.
Then the note turned to money and assets, things people in China readily talk about.
She works in Shanghai's education and training sector. Income, around $30,000 a year, owns an apartment in Shanghai, seeking an unmarried man with a bachelor's degree or higher.
Eric He is a college graduate, but he says he's not an eligible candidate, mostly because his residential registration is in the Chinese countryside rather than in Shanghai, which limits his ability to buy a home, get any future children into schools, or retire here. That's a deal-breaker for many Shanghai parents, including this mother standing nearby.
If he's not registered to Shanghai, that won't work. My daughter has an apartment. She's registered to Shanghai, has a good job, a good education. I want a son-in-law with the same background as her.
That may sound harsh, but Eric He gets her point. Opportunity is everything here. That's why he came to work in Shanghai.
I have a colleague who earned $77,000 in commission in 1 month. If I have one or two big opportunities like that, I can change my life.
And people without college degrees have far fewer opportunities. The Zhou family from eastern Jiangxi province worked in Shanghai for years, but low salaries and lack of Shanghai registration eventually drove them out. The son, Zhou Chaogang, returned to the city as an adult and ended up in a factory that paid him less than $9,000 a year. He quit after 3 months.
I feel lost. I don't know what to do in Shanghai. Food and rent are very expensive. It's just so hard to survive here.
He and Eric He were outside of Shanghai spending time with their families when China went into lockdown. They couldn't return for months. And that's when Eric He started to rethink his Shanghai dream.
Shanghai is such a stressful city, and I've always wanted to be closer to my parents.
He found another real estate job near his home village, and with the help of his parents, even bought an apartment.
My salary is higher than in Shanghai. The company pays into my social security and my housing fund, which I didn't get in my Shanghai job. I also get perks like a cake for my birthday.
As for ex-factory worker Zhou Chaogang, he hasn't returned to Shanghai either. Before he left the city last year, he and his friends stopped in a karaoke booth at a mall. It's a stress reliever. They chose a song from an 80s Cantonese rock band called Beyond, about sticking to your dreams. Zhou Chaogang's dream is to make enough money to pay off his credit cards and gambling debts. He's still trying to make it in other cities. In Shanghai, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
We talked about the minimum wage a bit yesterday. The origin story is what Chrissy Clark gave us, how when it was written, the Fair Labor Standards Act was specifically designed to make it hard for companies not to pay the legal minimum and overtime pay. But in this part two of her story, Chrissy explains that from the very beginning, there have been companies and whole industries that have found the loophole, starting right when it was passed in 1938, when agricultural and domestic workers were cut out.
At the time, some lawmakers pointed to administrative reasons why farm and domestic workers were initially excluded from the minimum wage, said it would be hard to make the law work in those jobs since their hiring and payment was often informal, without much record keeping. But there's another reason farm and domestic workers were excluded that goes to something ugly. Bill Spriggs is an economics professor at Howard University. He's also the chief economist for the AFL-CIO. And he says in order to get the minimum wage law passed, there had to be buy-in from politicians across the country, including the Southern Democrats. And they had a very particular world order they were trying to enforce, one of white supremacy.
And the South did not want that disturbed.
As a white lawmaker from Florida put it at the time, having a minimum wage that applied equally to white and black people, quote, just will not work in the South. So Northern Democrats in Congress made what's been called a devil's bargain.
The compromise with them was, okay, you can't say this only goes to white people. So the compromise is you can exclude certain occupations, agricultural workers, domestic workers, but in the South that means we don't want black people to get this.
Because it just so happened, agricultural workers and domestic workers were disproportionately black in the South and in the West, Latinx. And so for the first few decades after a federal minimum wage was passed, those workers were not covered by it. But civil rights activists pushed back. At the March on Washington, broadening coverage to farm and domestic workers was a key demand.
We demand that there be an increase in the national minimum wage so that men may live in dignity.
Eventually, it worked.
We have included more than 9 million new workers under a higher minimum wage.
Though, even now, some farm and domestic workers still aren't covered. But once some of those biggest holes in our minimum wage laws were addressed, there's another crack in the system that Americans working in all types of industries are still falling through, especially people of color. It has to do with the fact that the Fair Labor Standards Act and many state minimum wage laws require that employers pay a minimum wage to their employees. But there are some businesses who say our workers are not employees. Take app-based gig companies like Uber, Lyft, and DoorDash. They classify their drivers as independent contractors. In the last few years, officials in some states have pushed back on that approach. They've filed lawsuits to ensure app-based drivers are classified as employees and get standard minimum wage protections. But in response, gig app companies have doubled down.
If drivers are forced to become employees, up to 90% of app-based driving jobs could disappear.
That's an ad for Proposition 22, a ballot measure in California that the companies wrote and sponsored. It would provide drivers a few narrow benefits, but it would explicitly exempt them from California's standard minimum wage, as well as other basic employment laws. Last November, Prop 22 passed. It was the most expensive ballot measure in U.S. history. Similar measures have already been introduced in other states.
And I think that there's an interesting analogy to be made here.
Vina Dubal is a professor of law at the University of California, Hastings. She says she sees troubling echoes from history in the way Prop 22 carved out drivers for app-based gig companies from standard state employment laws. Drivers who, like agricultural and domestic workers, are also predominantly people of color.
And I think the concern of many sort of observers and analysts and the workers themselves is that this is going to exacerbate and entrench poverty in a moment where we are already living under heightened racialized inequality.
I reached out to some of the companies behind Prop 22 and received a response from the pro-Prop 22 coalition that they fund. In a written statement, they pointed to the, quote, accessibility of economic opportunity that app-based work provides. Vina Dubal, the law professor, says even if the law these gig app companies crafted wasn't purposely trying to create a lower set of employment protections for people of color, there is racial impact.
Why is it okay for a primarily immigrant people of color workforce to have a completely different set, a lowered set of protections than every other worker?
That's a question we should be asking ourselves, Dubal says, as we think about how employment is regulated in the gig economy. I'm Chrissy Clark from Marketplace.
Our podcast, The Uncertain Hour, which Chrissy hosts, and whence this story came, is all about how work and employment has changed in this economy this season. It's all out now. Check it out on the platform of your choice. This final note on the way out today, in which I am pretty sure I called it. Remember yesterday and the whole Volkswagen rebranding name change thing and them leaning into electric vehicles? Yeah, no. The Wall Street Journal reports today it was an April Fool's joke released into the wild a couple of days early. I should say here, and for the record, I'm no fan of April Fool's. Don't at me. All right, we got to go, but here is your moment of economic context today. Saw this one in Fortune that LinkedIn is going to start adding some new job title options to its profiles to account for the way the American workforce has changed in this pandemic. And among them will be the category of stay-at-home mom to help the 2.3 million women who have left the labor force or been forced out, I should say, in the past year to help them normalize that gap in their resumes. Digital and on-demand around here is done by Carrie Barber, Janet Wynn, and Catherine Wiles. Star Nieves is our executive director of on-demand. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.